From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a philosopher muses on the cultural importance of the Super Bowl. Then we learn how the Super Bowl ads try to tap into a magical formula that will make them stick with audiences.
Brand awareness, brand reminder, brand advantages, and then maybe a feel-good kinds of advertising tactics.
Bubbler Talk meets the man behind Wisconsin's witty highway safety messages, and we'll meet the Flash Knights, a local couple that illuminate abandoned places through their photography, quite literally.
We got into this train yard. He gave me this Vivitar flash and a little purple gel over the top. And he's like, head on into the train, and then just keep pressing this button. And so I did, and I came out of the train, looked at his little LCD screen on his camera, and I was just like hooked.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. There are many reasons we watch the Super Bowl. Maybe it's the halftime guests and that big production that surrounds them. Or maybe it's the ads. Companies really step up their game, knowing millions of people will be watching and talking about them. Or it could be the love of the game itself. Well, whatever your reasons for watching, you are participating in a cultural phenomenon. James South is a professor of philosophy at Marquette University, and he's a pop culture expert. We asked him to talk with us about the Super Bowl to explain why it's such a cultural touchstone in American society.
There are certainly historical precedents for the Super Bowl throughout human history, from the Olympics in ancient Greece to today, the Super Bowl or any other national championship kind of game. There seems to be something about the nature of competition and excellence in competition that appeals to human beings.
Okay, so I was thinking, as I was making notes to myself, I was thinking, is this our Roman spectacle?
I think it's certainly one of our Roman spectacles. I think it's our most Roman of spectacles.
Our own gladiators and entertainment.
When you think about the NBA championship or the World Series or Wimbledon or something like that, you don't have the same pre-build-up, you don't have the same halftime show, you don't have the same sort of cultural excitement about it, that even people who otherwise don't watch football will watch that game, sometimes just for the advertising.
That's one of my things. We'll get to that in a minute. But I'm wondering why football? Why do you think it is this particular sport that encourages this kind of adulation?
I think the violence has something to do with it, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think it's a contact sport. Other than hockey, I can't think of more of a contact sport that's prevalent in the USA or North America. And so I think that the competition, at any point a fight could break out, a disagreement.
Bloodlust.
Yes, there's just something. And there's also something about the admiration for the two teams that actually make it to this game. Even if you don't have any local investment in them, you realize they've undergone a very grueling season. They're all hurt, they're all injured, they're all bruised, and yet they're out there still playing their hearts out.
Yeah, and you know, I'm more of a baseball fan than I am a football fan, and I wonder, is it just the lack of violence? Because baseball doesn't really have that, and they have a grueling season, and you know, you get to the World Series, and may the best two of the teams win, kind of thing. But it seems like it's a much more genteel way of competing.
Well, I think in baseball, there's not one chance, right? This you win or you lose a Super Bowl on one day. And on any given day, any team can beat any other team. Over a course of a 7-game series and a World Series, that's very different. And so the concentration of the Super Bowl is, I think, a really important, attractive element to it.
What about the money? Because there's a lot of money both spent and made. Is that part of the appeal, too, that this, like, huge, opulent, lavish spectacle?
I think it is. I think it's a way that we indulge ourselves into thinking that this means something really important to not just us, but to the teams that are playing, to the areas that are represented, to the culture at large. And again, I'm not myself a huge football fan, but I'm going to watch the game because I'm going to want to talk about it around the water cooler the next day.
And I think that's an important point you make there, too, is that is it one of those things that gathers all of us together in a way that other things don't?
Well, I think having so many different teams in the NFL is something that brings communities into the cycle that leads into the series. So even though I know there are lots of Green Bay Packers fans who are very disappointed that they're not going to be playing on Sunday, at the same time, they've been watching the Packers play all these other teams for 17 games or 16 games, and of course they're going to be interested in this. And there's a tendency for us to take sides regardless. And is there an underdog? Do we root for the underdog? Do we root for the team that we think is going to win? The amount of betting that goes on about this?
That is a whole different money piece.
A very different money piece, but a very crucial money piece because, like I said, on any given day, any team can beat another team. And upsets occur routinely in the Super Bowl. I remember as a kid when the New York Jets won the Super Bowl, and it was such a big upset, and it launched Joe Namath's career. And I was in the bookstore yesterday, and he's got an autobiography out, right? We haven't forgotten Joe Namath because of that upset.
Well, and I was thinking of all the bookies who either made or lost that day when
exactly.
they upset
exactly.
as well and probably changed the course of a lot of different careers. You mentioned the ads, and of course, people who are not football fans at all will often tune in simply to watch the advertisements, which have become their own thing. And obviously, that's a big part of this, too. When did that first start happening, when the ads became almost as important as the game itself?
I'm not a historian of this by any means, but in my recollection, and I mean, and I'm old enough to remember the first retroactively called Super Bowl, I don't remember this being this big of a deal until the late 80s. And certainly that's when people started introducing new items, trying to sell their primary product, the top-of-the-line product. This year we've got Mike Bloomberg, who's got an advertisement on the Super Bowl. That must be costing him a fortune, but he can afford it, and he thinks he's got a reason to do it. And
he's certainly going to have an audience.
And he's going to have a built-in audience. That's right. And as you said, I know that the day after the Super Bowl, even if I've watched it, I will go on YouTube and I will watch the compilation of ads because people put a lot of money and creative time into those ads for Super Bowl games that they don't put into other ads.
Some of them are fabulous.
Because they want to be talked about.
Right.
Yes.
And they
want to be associated with that excitement and competitiveness of the Super Bowl.
And we mentioned the halftime show, and that is another big cultural. I mean, for somebody to be invited to be the main halftime performer is a huge career boost. If they aren't already superstars like Beyonce, but that's still a boost for her.
That's correct.
Yeah.
No, or they wouldn't agree to do it.
Right.
And, of course, we know there have been both controversial and non-controversial Super Bowl halftime shows. And, again, that's something that just seems different from other professional sports.
Yeah, it does to me, too, is like we've got this whole culture around this one thing that is even separate from the rest of the football season.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
It is an extra long halftime because they've got to do this spectacle. And I mean, I remember going to baseball games when I was younger, and on the 4th of July, there'd be fireworks after the game. But that's not the same thing as a halftime show at the Super Bowl.
With fireworks and overflights and whatever else
all
is going on.
All of those things.
Yeah. The rigging alone for that, probably would feed a small city just on the pay for those guys.
Exactly. Yeah. And, of course, the people who want to be seen at the Super Bowl, too. Just being affiliated with the Super Bowl sometimes makes people who attend the Super Bowl seem more interesting to other people. So, I mean, that's why presidents go to the Super Bowl. It's why they invite the Super Bowl winner to the White House afterwards. These are ways of gaining cultural cachet somehow among sports fans.
So what about the people who don't like football? How do they fit into this? Is it in opposition to all of this?
I would guess it would depend on why they don't like football. As I said, I myself am not someone who watches football obsessively. I will occasionally watch a game, but I think those who don't like football are still interested in being able to talk about this particular game. It's an event. It's a once-a-year event. It's something that you know when you walk into work, most of your coworkers are going to have watched, or there's going to have been a controversy, or there's going to have been a blown call by an official, and the next thing you know, you want to talk about it. Right? You want to be able to talk about it. So I know often I read quickly in the morning articles about the Super Bowl or other football games so I can talk to people about them, even if I haven't watched them.
And so philosophically, where does this fall in the pantheon of Western philosophy? Is this Bacchus and Dionysus?
I tend to think it's a combination, right? So it's both Dionysian in terms of the excitement, the buildup, the release, the halftime show, the spectacle, the often accompanying violence that occurs with the winning team, you know, city after the game. Those are all very Dionysian things. On the other hand, you have to think about how much discipline these players and coaches have to be able to put all that out of their minds and play for 60 minutes without that getting in the way.
So it's both Apollonian and Dionysian.
It's both Apollonian and Dionysian.
Wow. I had never thought of football that way, particularly the Super Bowl. It was just...
Oh, but they have to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they can't pay attention to the halftime show. They have to be back in the locker room trying to figure out how they're going to play better in the second half, what corrections they're going to make. So the ability of professional athletes, this is, you know, what makes them professional, or dedicated athletes in other kinds of championships, is the self-control that they have to exercise even in the midst of all the chaos and celebrityness and social interest that's going on. They have to stay focused.
Yeah, that's happening just around them.
Yeah, so I would say at that point, they're being as focused as any philosopher could be.
When does something like the Super Bowl, or maybe how is the better question, how does it move from a pop culture thing to just culture? How does it influence our greater culture beyond the day and event itself?
Well, I think one way it seeps into the culture at large is, and I mean, and this gets back to thinking about the Olympics or thinking about the gladiators or something of that sort, is just the fact that they use Roman numerals to identify them. It makes it seem more important than saying the 2020 World Series. It doesn't sound nearly as exciting as Super Bowl 54 or 55 with Roman numerals, right? And so if you add that to it, you're giving the culture a sense that this game has a meaning to it and a history to it, and it's connected with a history of competition that you don't ordinarily get with other sporting events.
And you really don't. The Olympics, somewhat.
Somewhat.
But that's only once every 4 years.
And that's
well,
very,
every
and
two
that's
years.
Very national pride oriented. Or, you know, sometimes just an amazing athletic feat by somebody gets your attention, even if you're not rooting for that team. Right.
Right. So who are you going to be rooting for? Or are you going to be rooting for anyone? Or do you not want to say?
No, I will probably, I will probably be rooting for the Kansas City Chiefs for all the wrong reasons, right? Or at least one wrong reason, which is that one of my favorite photos from a Super Bowl ever is a picture of Lynn Dawson, the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs in the Super Bowl. And he's sitting there, and it's on this very sparse sideline, not with any of the high-tech gear that we see today. He's got this wrap around him, and he's smoking a cigarette. And I just go, that's hardcore. And so there's something about the Kansas City Chiefs because of that picture. And that's what's so interesting about affiliations when, I mean, if you live in San Francisco, you're going to root for the 49ers. If you live in Kansas City or the Midwest, maybe you're going to root for the Chiefs, you're going to root for the underdog, whatever reasons that you might have for rooting for a team. But there's always that one thing that really hooks you individually and uniquely to a team that makes you root for them, I think.
So that photo was yours?
That photo is mine, and so I'll be rooting for the Chiefs. I know nothing about, really, the Kansas City Chiefs season, except they had a good one. I know they have a good team, but could I name
any of the players?
The starting lineup? No, I couldn't, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I feel, you know, sort of bad about that, but you didn't invite me on to analyze the Super Bowl. So.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, James South, we'll see you at the water cooler the day after.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
James South is a professor of philosophy at Marquette University and an expert in pop culture. He will be watching the Super Bowl on Sunday. He'll be watching those ads, too, and we'll learn more about them when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we learned about the philosophy of the Super Bowl, and while people do watch it for the actual sporting event, many non-football fans love to watch the game for the commercials. The audience has been steadily growing every year of the 50 years the Super Bowl has been in existence, and in the last 20, the Super Bowl has achieved the largest television audience for any single television show. And, of course, that means advertisers are looking to find those audiences. TV networks stand to gain about $250 million in ad sales during the Super Bowl, but it's crucial that the commercials stand out in their own playing field. So what makes them memorable, and do they really work? To find out more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Jim Pokrzywinski. He's an associate professor of strategic communication at Marquette, and he begins by explaining how these commercials reflect on the companies who invest in such expensive airtime.
Certainly they get a lot of exposure before the game as well as after, which does not happen in any other advertising context for the most part. So there's certainly that particular value. I think there's certain objectives that you may be more successful at achieving through a Super Bowl ad, and that is brand awareness, brand reminder, brand advantages or benefits over the competition. And then maybe a feel-good if you use humor or nostalgia or some of those kinds of advertising tactics to make the audience have that awe factor at the end that they connect with a particular brand.
Right, having that emotional tie, you know, and I'm sure ad companies are still seeking a, quote, magic formula for the composition of a automatically successful ad campaign. But with the Super Bowl, as you brought up before, it is truly unique that people extend the lives of these commercials well after. Because
yes,
especially in today's digital world, all of these, I'm sure, will be article subjects in themselves come after the game, no matter what kind of football game it is.
Yes, and the practice of releasing the commercial in advance, when I first saw this happening, maybe within the last 5 years, I think that it's happened for just about every advertiser on the Super Bowl, that they would let you see the commercial in advance. I thought that was a bad idea at first, and to some degree I still do, because it kind of takes away that anticipation and excitement of seeing the next commercial and what the commercial is going to say. So, so you have surprise associated with the ad you're about to see when you're watching it live. But now the practice seems to be to give you a teaser, maybe a 15-second snippet of the commercial, or not even the commercial itself, but literally a tease that, you should look for this ad with this celebrity in it, and that's about the extent of the information you gain. And so I think that really extends the conversation and the exposure that an advertiser gets from, paying the ungodly money that it costs to buy a single 30-second commercial, not to mention companies like Anheuser-Busch that'll be buying, seven, eight, nine spots during the game for a variety of different brands in their portfolio, or sort of more general corporate advertisement about Anheuser-Busch or Budweiser flagship brand.
Of course. And on that note, how much does your average 30 or 60 second commercial cost to buy from the network that's airing the Super Bowl? What is the average cost nowadays?
I think it's in the $5.5 million rate this year. Of course, there's always negotiation, so if Anheuser-Busch buys 8 or 10, they're not paying $5.5 million apiece, but they're probably paying at least $4 million or $3.5 million apiece. So I just saw a notice today that Donald Trump and Mike Bloomberg are both putting down the neighborhood of $20 million to buy a couple of spots during the Super Bowl. We'll see how many spots they get for $20 million. If that's four, if that's five, that was news item that came out today that I saw.
Is that a pretty recent development that politics is now thrown into the mix of, you know, technically anyone can buy a spot if they have the money, but we always associate it with physical products, something that's a call to action to say, hey, go buy something.
Yeah. Well, it's not unprecedented, especially if it's in an election year, that we've had candidates in 2016, 2012 that have bought spots. And given the contested nature that's likely to unfold with this election year, I'm not sure that I have ever seen any political advertising other than presidential candidates, governor's races, state senator races, or local races, unless they bought, spots just on the local station that's carrying the Super Bowl. But I don't think I've seen any political advertising from any individual candidates other than presidents over time. Just this is not the first year it's ever happened.
Just perhaps more noticeable this time around.
Yes, yes, and maybe more frequent too. I don't know that I've seen more than a spot or two by a candidate during the Super Bowl, and it looks like here we might be seeing maybe up to five by each of these candidates. So interesting.
Yeah, and on the note of course, people recognition, the power of celebrity. Celebrity endorsements are often highly sought after for whatever product or company is making a commercial. So do you think that it's still as powerful today with all of the platforms we have with access to celebrities' lives or knowing what they're doing? Is the power of a celebrity in a commercial still what it was back in that first infamous Farrah Fawcett shaving cream ad of that Super Bowl?
There's probably a diminishing factor in the use of celebrities. But if you find the right celebrity and put that person in the right context, I think you still can have a very powerful message. It's also one that you really have to do your due diligence to make sure it's a person that, is going to be a positive for your brand and not a negative.
Yes.
So there's always some risk involved in that, but I think there's still plenty of examples every year of, good celebrity matches with the particular brands. I've seen this the preview for Doritos commercial with MC Hammer, and although he's been a entertainer that might be a little past his prime in terms of popularity, I think enough people will recognize him, and the context in which MC Hammer is used in this Cheetos commercial, getting the cheesy bits stuck to his fingers while he's sitting at the piano contemplating a new song, and gets the brainstorm of that he can't touch this, his popular song, because it's his hand is full of Cheetos cheese bits, is a good match for a celebrity endorsement.
Well, and sometimes puppies and Clydesdales are the magic formula.
Yes, yes. Those certainly, are very popular at generating awe factors, and so we'll see what Budweiser ultimately utilizes. They're kind of going with at least in one of their preview commercials, talking about, diverse populations and diverse circumstances. And Budweiser is always a part of all of those, various situations, celebrations, evenings together, and everything in between. We'll see whether puppies and horses appear again this year or not.
Now, how far in advance are companies and ad agencies planning out their commercials for the Super Bowl?
Well, literally a month or two after each Super Bowl, the planning would begin, starting with what budget might be available to, what is the message that we want to deliver, and ultimately how we're going to deliver it. And it is easily a 10-month process, if not several days after the Super Bowl, once the results come in on what you may have done last year. If you were a repeat participant in Super Bowl advertising, that planning would start again real soon.
Now, what do you think are some of the most famous ads in Super Bowl history that are still talked about and viewed today as a prime example of how to effectively make a memorable commercial?
Well, it goes all the way back to Apple's introduction of their Mac computer. usually is at the top of most lists of very successful commercials, the ability to, in a very surprising, unexpected way, introduce an exciting new product to the marketplace. So that one has survived the test of time for, I think it was an ad in the 80s, maybe mid-80s. And so, you know, we're talking about 35, 40 years that that one still at the top of the list and most people's list of the greatest Super Bowl commercials of all time. Some of those Budweiser spots, particularly I think the one right after 9/11, which the Clydesdales bow to the New York skyline, have you know, been ones that touched people and lasted as a memory device for folks. And you know, after that, you know, isolated instances here and there. But those would be the two that come to my mind as being among the greatest of all time.
Right. And you mentioned that memorable factor. But at the end of the day, despite all the money paid to buy a slot to produce these commercials, are they effective? Does it influence people's spending habits? Are there numbers and data that show, look at these products advertised and look at what people are doing with them after?
Well, certainly that's harder to be able to track than you would like for it to happen. But indeed, the success comes through in a variety of different ways, whether it ultimately led to a immediate sale or not is probably the one of the lesser objectives that a Super Bowl ad would have. It would be bringing brand awareness to the top of someone's mind, so when they are facing this decision, particularly when it has to do with non-durable product purchases that are made on a regular basis, like beverages, food, snack chips, etc., or what retail outlet to visit, that you've got that top of mind awareness from that exposure and the conversation that happened before and after about it. And then there's also the feel good within the company, its employees, that they got their friends talking about a Super Bowl ad for the company that they work for, the stockholders that see the company continuing to do well. So there's a variety of different audiences that will benefit from if a Super Bowl commercial is done right, performs well, gets positive ratings. Of course, the flip side is likely to occur as well. But in terms of moving the sales meter, there certainly is a lot of other things the company has to do over the course of the year in order to make sure that sales meter moves in the right direction as well. We've got Budweiser introducing their new seltzer product, so that's one that you might be able to evaluate more directly to, is there going to be a sales bump after that product is introduced? You got a car manufacturer that is talking about a self-parking benefit to it. And so these new product benefits and features or new products on the market would be easier ones to be able to evaluate what kind of sales bump a Super Bowl ad does than existing brands like Budweiser, Coke, McDonald's, and whoever else might participate.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see to see who wins the Super Bowl of commercials this coming weekend.
Yes.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you very much.
Well, nice talking to you, Audrey.
Jim Pokrzywinski is an associate professor of strategic communication at the Dietrich College of Communication at Marquette University. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And to look at some of those memorable commercials that we discussed in the interview, head over to WUWM.com. Coming up next, Bubbler Talk meets the man behind Wisconsin's witty highway safety messages. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
When you're driving to work, there's nothing worse than seeing a traffic sign that shows delays ahead. But if you're like firefighter Drew Schuster, there is one thing you look forward to seeing: the witty safety messages.
Well, I travel to and from Mequon and Germantown probably at least 5 or 6 times a week to Milwaukee. So I pass by these signs all the time.
Schuster describes them as dad jokes, and you might be familiar with some of them, like camp in the woods, not the left lane, or life is fragile, slow down. Sometimes they're tied to holidays or they reference pop culture. All of these messages come from the same place, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, and more specifically, its Traffic Management Center. The center is responsible for, well, managing traffic. And they do this using a lot of different tools, like roadway sensors, cameras on the highway, and these digital traffic boards, also known as dynamic message signs. The signs offer a lot of different information to drivers throughout Wisconsin, including travel times and weather advisories. They're also a prime spot to include these safety reminders. And over the past year, you may have noticed an influx in these snappy traffic messages. That's thanks to John Riemann. He's the man behind the screens writing and editing these messages.
I started saying, we could be doing more. We can certainly be getting more creative with them, doing them more often, and all of that. So now we're up to somewhere, I like to balance it around 20 to 22 days. I don't want it to be something where there's a message every day. But I also want it to be where, you know, we weren't running the same message for a week at a time or a month at a time.
It should be noted that this is just a small part of his job. As Riemann is quick to point out, he's a communications manager. He doesn't spend his whole day writing these messages. And he also doesn't actually come up with all of them by himself. He relies on a team of people from around the state that include folks from law enforcement, traffic engineers, and safety engineers, the same people who interact with the Traffic Management Center on a daily basis. There's a hodgepodge of emails and phone calls suggesting different messages for the monthly calendar. And coming up with them is both an art and a science.
It can be a challenge because we are dealing with a very finite number of characters. I always like to say it's worse than Twitter, you know, where you get the 240 characters. This is 3 lines of 18 characters. So you're pretty limited as to trying to get a, you know, a message out in a very succinct manner.
Wisconsin isn't the only state that's trying to zhuzh up its safety reminders, but it does stand out among the crowd, in part due to the volume of messages each month.
I did actually hear from a colleague in another state, and I won't call him out, but when we asked, oh, what's your frequency of change on it, the email that I got back was something to the effect of, well, we've had the same message up for about 6 months now.
Many states play on local cliches. Here that means things like make it to deer camp, drive sober. In other states like Louisiana, Riemann says they get a little bit more risque with phrases like slow the flock down. And you might be asking yourself, at what point are these messages less about safety and more about entertainment? In Louisiana, it seems their racy messages are having a real impact.
They did a study on some of the messages that they had on one of their causeway bridges, and they did actually notice a reduction in crashes that were happening because they were reminding people, to slow down and don't tailgate and all of that.
But let's get back to Schuster's core question about Riemann.
I wanted to know, is it, in fact, a dad that's writing these? Because who else can come up with that kind of humor?
The answer is yes. Riemann does happen to be a father, which adds to his dad joke credentials. But his son William is just 2 years old, and Riemann says he's really just approaching that first level of dad joke punnetry. Regardless of his dad credentials, Schuster says he's still impressed with Riemann's work. And whether or not you enjoy these messages, Riemann says that if it just makes you think about driving safely, it's all worth it. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino, home to 24/7 entertainment, dining, and musical acts, plus Ember Salon and Spa, and Topgolf Swing Suite. More at paysbig.com. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk. We'll take one last break and then how a full moon, a flashlight, and a camera can make unique art out of lost Americana. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's pitch dark, and you're driving down a road in the middle of nowhere. Then you see an abandoned structure, and you decide to go exploring. Well, that sounds like the opening of a particularly gruesome horror flick, but it's what Chris and Katie Robleski do with their night photography.
The couple call themselves the Flash Knights, and for half the year, they're out investigating abandoned structures in the dark and, in the process, illuminating history. With just a full moon, a flashlight, and long exposure photography, they turn lost Americana into unique art, usually while trespassing. The Milwaukee natives joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski while they were here on their winter break. Chris Robleski starts by explaining how he became interested in night photography.
15 years ago, I was just kind of wanting a challenge and needed to get out. I had lost my parents, and I thought, what better way to go out at night with a flashlight in a freezing cold? It was January 1st, 15 years ago, actually. This is my 15-year anniversary of doing it, and I liked the challenge of it. And fast forward 5 years, I met Katie via the internet.
The magic of dating sites.
Yeah. The magic of dating sites. And
I had seen his work. Obviously, he introduced me to, he like sent me his, this was back when Flickr was a thing, and he sent me his Flickr site. And I was like, oh man, this is so cool. He's like, yeah, let's, I'll show you how to do it. And we got into this train yard. He gave me this Vivitar flash and a little purple gel over the top. And he's like, head on into the train, and then just keep pressing this button. And so I did, and I came out of the train, looked at his little LCD screen on his camera, and I was just like hooked. It was so cool.
And I suppose that says a lot about both of your personalities. That's like, hey, you want to go to an abandoned so-and-so and just take this, flash this for a while. I'll tell you when to come back.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned you just use a simple flashlight. Is that the extent of the tools that you use for these night shoots?
Yeah, we go out during full moons, so we need an external, other than just our flashlight. Otherwise, it would just be really dark imagery. There's a lot of timing and science stuff that we kind of mow through and just kind of like create the art on the other side of the camera. But yeah, we started out with simple flashes and then flashlights. And then a guy in San Francisco created this flashlight that has multiple colors, every color under the rainbow, in fact, called Proto Machine. And we use that now because we used to put these little colored gels like you'd see in a theater. Bands have them over their lights so you can see their colored stage show. But we'd always lose them, and they'd fall off somewhere, or they'd get all crumply and create these weird colors. So we morphed into this flashlight, and now we just basically have a camera, flashlight, and then hopefully a full moon. But that doesn't always happen.
Yeah. Chris mentioned adversity, and there's a lot that has to do with the weather, for example. Usually we go out during clear skies so you can get star trails because of the long exposure. You can kind of see the way the Earth's moving and the star trails in the sky. This one time we drove, it's 4 hours from here down in Illinois, and clouds were starting to roll in, but we had already paid like, I don't know, $5 in tolls. So we're like, ugh. And we were just like, let's just check out the house because we had never seen it before. And most of the time when we roll up on these places, we don't see them in the daylight. They're just, you know, it's pitch black when we get there. And we got there, and just with some experimentation, like Chris said, with the flashlight that we have because it's so powerful, we got like one of our best shots. And it was like pure cloud cover, no moon. Just by using the flashlight, it turned out pretty cool.
And so, you only need one in these buildings, or do you just kind of play it by ear and set up multiple?
It's just one. So it's basically me going inside. Like, Chris is the camera guy. He's like the composition man. And then I'm the light painter. And I go inside and I go from room to room to room, just lighting up each of the rooms. So it's a quick, like, depending on how much ambient light we have, it can be like a minute to 5 minutes. But sometimes a minute to do a two-story house, I'm just booking it through, like, up these stairs that have no banister. There's like holes in the ground, like holes in the floor. And it's pitch black again because I can only use the flashlight so many times, so I don't show up. So it's like it's a whole ordeal. It takes,
so you're doing it room to room as quickly as you can,
mm-hmm,
to get that full image captured.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some of these buildings do not look very structurally sound.
No.
So do you scope out before you go in and paint the light? Do you like say like, okay, here's kind of like my running route, so to speak?
We're lucky, I can do that. And sometimes
if you're not trespassing.
Yeah, sometimes we're dealing with like neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in the middle of nowhere, you can hear just like every single step. And we've run into that before where neighbors are like, they come in their pickup truck with their dog on one side and probably a rifle on the other.
Right. I can't imagine it's a welcome sight to see like, what are all these strange lights going down on my
like
property?
The aliens have landed.
Yeah, we often wonder, like, I wonder if if we were driving by, what would we do? Would we stop if I saw a green or purple light coming out of a house? Or would I would just chalk that up to say, like, you know what, let's just move on and carry on with our day. But yeah, we usually walk together through with a bright white light before we set up. But even that doesn't show all the... we always go in with the less is more. Like, if you see a hole in the floor, you're probably going to be like, all right, there's the hole. Don't worry about the boards that are cracking to the hole and just kind of walk through there. And there is some adversity. That's what we kind of like, the challenge.
Yeah.
And it's preserving history, too. So,
well, not, a little not adrenaline with some history.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like. Yeah. Because any crick or crack, sometimes, like Katie was saying, the neighborhood dogs, those are the rural alarm clocks, if you will. And then in the inner city stuff that we do, we don't really have to worry as much, but, you know, because people are like, oh, you're in East St. Louis, it's such a terrible place, or Detroit, it's such a terrible place, or Gary, and I'm like, nah, it's, we, you know, we're, it's dark, we're inside of a building, they probably might even be frightened of us,
like,
and I mean, I say they, I mean just the neighbors, or whoever's walking by, they got their own world to worry about, so we've only had one instance where someone was kind of frightening. But that was with
Most times, do they come around when you explain, like, hey, this is what we're doing, or, you know.
We were in South Dakota at a ghost town with, I shouldn't say a ghost town. There's one guy living there, and it was a huge development for.
It was like a ranch.
Yeah,
a
rancher. He's a rancher, and he heard us in the ghost town part where there's just, like, hundreds of cars and buildings and banks and stuff. So we were just, like, wandering around. And all of a sudden, I saw this pickup truck and a dog, and I was like, okay. I go, Katie, why don't you go talk to him?
Like,
she's prettier.
Like an innocent
lady.
Yeah,
I was like, threatening image.
Yeah.
But he was like, okay, whatever. Just have fun, I guess.
Sure.
He was probably thinking, like, why are they taking pictures in the dark?
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, we just had... That ended up being fun when you have kind of a permission situation. But most times, there's nobody anywhere near us.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm more worried about, like, wolves and coyotes and... pheasants, I found out, are pretty vicious.
Oh,
they can,
no.
like, peck your shins apart while you're standing there. So, and the cold weather. We've gotten really far down there in the temperatures. We've done we did some shoots outside of Stevens Point, an old church. And
Gleason,
Wisconsin, which is way north. And we did it on New Year's Eve.
And it was zero.
It was negative.
Yeah.
And we left with chilblains, which are nasty, just as bad as frostbite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So with these places, you know, you're going to the Dakotas, here in Wisconsin, elsewhere. How do you find or scope out these locations? Because I imagine they're not exactly on a map. They're not like your fiberglass oddities that are kind of roadside attractions or things like that. So. Yeah. How do you find them? What attracts you to them?
I do a lot of Google satellite earthing. Some people will not tell me them. So I do get a lot of intel from other people. They're like, all right, I know this place. And then sometimes I see a picture and I'm like, oh, this would be really cool at night because it's like an old gas station in the middle of a New Mexico desert. And I mean, when I was looking for it, all I saw was a silhouette and I was hoping that it was the building. So I parked off the road. There was a cattle gate and I hiked about a mile in, and I was like, this is it, you know, but I had no intel other than just...
Like zooming in from, like,
zoomed
Google.
In from Google Earth, and, you know, if the roof is missing, obviously no one's there, because, you know, what would they be? Because there was a house right next to it, but I was confused where the road was, so it was kind of like the intrigue of doing it, but I did it at 3 a.m. with a guy from Texas, and I was getting pretty tired, and he was getting pretty tired, and then he was losing interest in doing it, but... it was kind of like the white whale because there's no road to it or anything. So I use Google Earth a lot. People give us tips and pointers, and sometimes we just happenstance upon them.
Yeah.
Dakotas
for sure.
North and South Dakota.
Driving around.
Wyoming.
Yeah.
Well, and how great that your profession gives you that flexibility to stumble upon your next shoot.
Yeah.
For sure. Our GPS is just chock full of all the places we see, like, during the day, and we're like, oh, now for next time. As long as you don't get your GPS stolen out of your car.
Which did happen just down the road from here.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then we like kind of, the other part of the is that we have a lot of time to kill in the day, and we try to visit in town, however small it is, because we have no fears there either. If we're going in buildings in the dark, we have no fear. So we try to find some like small town people to talk to and then, you know, drink, have a beer or some food or whatever, being vegetarians in the middle of the prairies gets to be a challenge.
Yep.
So, but,
yep.
But the people are really nice. Everywhere we go, they're always like, kind of like, what do you do? And
I'm sometimes
like, this is a living? And I'm like, yeah.
And sometimes
it is.
They remember us. We went to North Dakota again, like the next year, and we stayed in the same little motel, little mom and pop motel. And we told her, oh, we're just in photo. We're taking these photos at night. And she's like, I remember you from last year. And we're just like, what? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess like taking photos at night. Yeah.
How many people like talk about flashlights and photos?
Right.
So it's kind of nice. So we've built like a rapport with some of these people because we want to be on the good side of the,
Yeah, because it's technically can be trespassing sometimes.
Yeah. So we try to like get as much permission, but most of the people or places we go, as mentioned, other than some of the inner city stuff, I've done some pretty scary things in Detroit. Not the people, it's the buildings are scary because they're like dark hallways of
just crumbling.
And like, I probably shouldn't be in here, but there was a hotel in Gary, Indiana, which they took down. And I went to the top and went on the roof, and I'm older, so I was like, I probably shouldn't be doing this. But I met her, and then that made me not do as many crazy.
Okay, you go do it.
Yeah.
I'm like, now I don't do as many crazy things.
Sure. And that's kind of how it came about, because he didn't have health insurance when we met. He was just, kind of like a freelance guy. And I was working at, like, Kohl's or something. And so I was like, you can't go in there anymore. I'm going to do it. I've got the health insurance in case somebody breaks their leg or whatever.
Perfectly logical. When you mentioned that, these things they don't look good. Upon first glance and inspection, but then adding the dynamic of the different colored lights and the night exposure, makes them into beautiful photographs and art pieces.
Thank you.
And with some of the photos that our listeners can see online, I particularly am drawn to the Painted Desert Trading Post, Old Route 66, Arizona, because that you can kind of see like, here's a smaller building, and then you can see the bones furthermore on the inside. You see the plaster coming off the walls. You see the old ads on the outside and just those hidden gems. So when it comes to that one or any of the others that are on our website, what kind of memories do you associate with them?
Painted Desert
crucial.
That is, thanks for pointing that out. Route 66 was near and dear to us. We've traveled it many times, but that in particular it's not a drivable section. So we had to park our car at a gate, another cattle gate, and then hike the fence and walk 3 miles into the Painted Desert on the old stretch of Route 66. So for that one, that's extremely memorable. That's one of our most memorable, long exposure, things that we've done because, when you're walking out and you hear nothing, being in the city, we're right in the city of Milwaukee. So when we get to get out and there's like nothing but a blanket of stars above you, there's no sounds. You can barely
except for those snoring cows.
Yeah, we heard snoring. We heard snoring cows.
We weren't sure what it was. They were like, oh, it's just the cows. It's okay.
Yeah, there's like a tiny viaduct with like, 20 cows just snoring away. And I thought, I wonder if they're going to wake up because cows are pretty cool at night, but cattle, like the bulls, are not. So those are kind of frightening to be. I've been warned about that from ranchers and such. They're like, don't go walking out with the bulls because they get crazy and territorial. But that was like a very memorable, just because it was such a long hike. I left wearing shorts because it was 70, shorts and a t-shirt, and not knowing that the high desert drops.
Yeah.
Almost 40 to 50 degrees. We were running back
the
to the car
because
I was oh my God, I have shorts and a t-shirt on. It's like 35 degrees.
Running out to stay warm.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, I'm so cold. And I'm like, but we're in the desert. And then you wake up the next day, it's 100. You're like, this is a really weird thing.
Yeah. With going out and having such a drastic different experience finding these photographs versus when you're coming back, editing, traveling to art shows, interacting with people, do you find that it's the perfect balance because to be so immersed in your work in two different ways, that your time in the desert together, in nature, alone, nothing but cows and stars around you, that it feeds you in a good
it
way.
It does. It's the perfect, 6 month to 6 month kind of repetitious cycle that we do. The summer can be brutal. The shows, kind of like Chris said, with the 100 degrees, we did a show in Des Moines last summer, and it was above 100. It was like a heat index of 112 or something. And you're sweating it out on the concrete and talking to thousands of people, and you're just like, And we're not particularly extroverted, so there's that too. So you're just kind of wiped by the end of the season. But then we transition into the shooting all winter, and it is quite the nice balance.
Yeah. Why do you think people should appreciate this? I imagine people coming around at the stands at the art fair, they're not seeing photography like this. And what
that
are some people's
sure.
misconceptions or, you know?
That it's Photoshop every single time. And we have a giant sign. The signs have gotten progressively bigger and more there's a multitude of them that says no Photoshop, because everybody comes in and they say, oh, I thought this was all on the computer.
So that's one of the things, that being in the public eye as opposed to like a gallery or a museum, we have nowhere to hide. So we're in a 10 by 10 tent. Mm-hmm. It's usually hot. People, for the most part, have been blown away because they're like, wow, you don't use Photoshop, because our editing, we don't do anything unless there's like a dramatic swear word that we're like, you know, I really like the composition.
Let's take the graffiti out.
Let's take the graffiti out. Yeah. So that's about the extent of our editing. But everything is pretty much natural. I was inspired by photographers, O. Winston Link. He just put a piece of film in there, and then that was the end of it for his photograph. No, like, darkroom craziness or whatever. So, we love to see the effect of, we had a gentleman buy a picture for his very young son, and he like treasures it. He's like, we had this picture where we drew a door with light in the dark, and he was like so blown away by it. And so the reaction that we get is usually very, it's humbling to me, because I never had any intention of showing people this work other than just putting it on the internet. And I definitely never thought about having it be a career.
And shows and stuff.
Yeah, and then people just, it's usually like, they're either blown away. Occasionally we'll get the scoff where they're like, ugh, and they think it's Photoshop, and then they walk away, but I can't catch up to them to tell them, no, we're just using light and moonlight and light. So that's basically all of our work is just flashlight, moonlight, and a lot of patience.
Well, if the story isn't intriguing enough for people, I encourage them to look up just some of these photos and get captured even more. So, Chris and Katie, thank you so much for coming in to share your story.
Thank you so much. This is awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Katie and Chris Robleski are the Flash Knights. They joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski when they were back in Milwaukee. They'll be hitting the road once again once the weather warms up. And that wraps up the show today. If you're watching the Super Bowl, have a great time. I'm Bonnie North, and thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. All Things Considered comes up next. It's 4 o'clock.